We're carrying on this theme of the mind training. And I've been really, really enjoying this theme, actually, really enjoying it. So, yeah, it's great to be able to carry it on. So the mind training, it's also called, quite confusingly, the 7 points of training the mind. And that's confusing because there's about 50 slogans that are within the 7 points. But it sort of works out somehow. So we're going through the slogans. So there's lots of slogans that we can use and are using. And these slogans, they act as like a dharma folded up into easily memorized sentences. So you don't need a big book to carry them around. They're sort of designed to be memorized, carried around in your head or on these little wallet-sized cards as well. So, that's what the slogans are designed for, these compacted dharma that you can memorize. So you have them there with you. And it's ideal for applying them to events that happen in your own life because they're easy to recall, basically. They're easy to bring to mind. And most of them, if not all of them, are specifically tailored to be used in times of difficulty. So when the pressure's on and times of adversity and testing times, that's what these slogans are designed for. So the slogans are the kind of thing that you want to remember, say, like if you've broken down on the motorway and it starts to rain, you want a slogan at hand, or when you've been kept awake for the third night on retreat by snoring, want a slogan to hand. Or when your best friend falls out with you, or when you're blamed. So you want these slogans to hand. So this is the area that they deal with. And so they're designed to turn adverse conditions into the path to enlightenment, difficult situations into the path to enlightenment. So in our kind of more sort of Buddhist language, they're designed to turn dukkha into shraddha. So some of you know that's the start of the spiral path. So they use dukkha, unsatisfactoriness, disappointment, as a kind of fuel that propels you to enlightenment. And they're really brilliant teachings because we're unlikely to run out of fuel. So we're unlikely to run out of dukkha. So they're sort of inexhaustible, really, which is good. And some slogans use wisdom to transform suffering. Or difficult situations, and some use metta. And you could say that this is a metta one. So the slogan that I'm going to be talking about is this one. So train in taking and sending alternately, let them ride upon the breath. So it's good that it's self-explanatory. So definitely needs some packing. And it's quite a heavyweight one as well. It's one of the most testing slogans I think I know. So it needs a bit of building up to. So we're going to build up to it by looking at three areas. So the first one is bringing other people into your awareness. So bringing other people into our awareness. That's the first area. The second area is recognizing that our suffering, my suffering, is like your suffering. So our suffering is the same as other people's suffering. So that's the second area. And then the third area that I'm going to look at is the slogan particularly. So it describes a practice called Tonglen, which some of you like Tibetan Buddhism might already know about, which is basically breathing in the suffering of others and breathing out light and beauty. So why would you want to do that? So hopefully we'll... so hopefully I'll say why. Say why you don't do that. Yeah, good. Okay, so a bit more on the context, a bit more on dukkha, dukkha and shraddha. So I'm not going to give an extensive dukkha recap, because it's been done before in other talks. And the last talk that I gave on dukkha, I took quite a while to get over, actually. So I'm not going to go into dukkha extensively. But I will just say a few things. So there's been a few helpful angles on it recently that I've been told about, I've heard. And while I remember, I often I forget to quote my sources from talks. So I do just want to say that basically everything that I say that's helpful has basically come from the order. It's come from other people, and particularly Sangharakshita. So if I forget to quote sources, I'll try my best. But yeah, it's really worth saying that. Yeah, so yeah, these new angles on dukkha. So one of the questions that I've had sort of ongoing is, so if dukkha is the start of the Buddhist path, so it's the, you know, the first noble truth, et cetera, then do you have to be miserable to turn to Buddhism? So that's like a sort of question that I've sort of had going around for a few years. And I've got some way to sort of resolving that. So dukkha, I think a really good translation, I think I got this from Satyajyoti actually, is disappointment. So a good translation of dukkha is disappointment. So that's being slightly disappointed all the way to being like thoroughly, bitterly disappointed. And that's disappointment. You could say that things can't be controlled. So disappointment that you can't control things. Disappointment that impermanent things aren't permanent. We can't get things to last. And disappointment that while we've got a kind of separate self cut off from others, no matter how good we get it, we'll always want more, basically. We'll never be completely satisfied. So just say those again. So disappointment that things can't be controlled. So Sangharakshita's got this really lovely poem that I like called Life is King, and it's been around the sort of movement recently. And the last few lines are, life cannot belong to us, we belong to life. Life is king. So we cannot control life, basically. We belong to life. And that impermanent things aren't permanent. So I definitely thoroughly disapprove that my loved ones and friends and family are impermanent. That is a real huge, disappointment. I really disapprove of that. And also that, you know, I've had these moments of, sort of great joy, and they're all kind of tinged with, either it doesn't last or I want more. Yeah, so that's I think that's a good translation of dukkha, disappointment. So this disappointment is caused by having unreasonable expectations of what conditioned existence can provide. So unreasonable expectations, but not low standards. So I was thinking that Siddhartha, before he became the Buddha, he had this sort of outrageously high aspiration for complete freedom. And he visited all these teachers, and he learned all their methods, and he sort of came to really amazing mental states, but it was never sort of good enough for him. So, he refused to have anything less than complete freedom. So I think this is where Shraddha comes in, so from dukkha to Shraddha. So Shraddha is like having the highest expectations possible and knowing that they come from the unconditioned, from enlightenment. So it's understanding that our disappointment won't be solved on its own level, and that a path of ethics, meditation, and wisdom is the only good solution, the only real solution. And that's liberating because it puts all the responsibility back on us, basically. Our ability to respond to dukkha is back on us. And so I've got two pictures to show you. Be prepared for great artwork. Here's the first one. So like that sort of pie could be all our dukkha, all our disappointment. And we think what it appears to be in life is that most of the pie of disappointment is out of our control, and there's some bits that are in our control. That's sort of what it appears to be. But in fact, it's more like this. This is basically what the Buddha is saying, that almost all of it's in our control, and there's only a little bit that's out of our control. So this sort of in our control dukkha bit. This is where the mind training takes effect. So happiness is much more within our control than it appears. And with the effort of training, our minds, suffering and happiness become much more of a choice. Okay, so this our usual path of sort of disappointment, expectations, disappointment, is sort of replaced with disappointment, shraddha, appointment. Yeah, good. Okay. So just to set the context for this mind training about taking and sending, I'm going to tell a story. So it's a story of Kiso Gotami. And this is from Vedsantra's book, The Tales of Freedom. A really, really good book. I really recommend it. It's got a big tiger on the front. So that's how you know it's good. Okay, so... Okay, so once upon a time, in the time of the Buddha, there was a woman and she was called Kisa Gotami. And she was described as the daughter of nobody. Okay, the daughter of nobody. So Kisa means like, it's a bit of a nickname, like it means haggard or lean or skinny. And from a name like that, we can imagine that she has had a hard life. She's had a hard life. Although she's had a hard life and she's called lean, haggard and skinny, she marries and she moves in with her husband. And although her husband obviously loves her, her in-laws make life very, very difficult. Make life hard for her. And then something happens in Kisa Gotami's life, so she has a son. And that in India at that time, that gave her a particular status. Okay, so she had status. So she had status within her in-laws. So from a daughter of nobody, she turned into be a mother of somebody. So she lived for a while with much more respect from her in-laws, from her family, and with a husband that loved her and within his circle of family. And then the first tragedy struck, so her husband died. And she found herself surrounded by people who didn't love her, but she clung on to her son, basically, having a son for a source of meaning and respect. And then the second tragedy, her son became ill, and Gotami got sick with worry, and she could do nothing to help him, and he died. So she became completely lost in madness, in grief, and she couldn't accept that her son was dead. And she went from house to house carrying the dead body of her son, asking the people for medicine, saying that her son was very weak and sick. And each house she got, you know, she just got completely turned away. And eventually someone suggested that she should go and see the Buddha, which she did. So mad with grief, she went to see the Buddha to ask if he could cure her son. And the Buddha replied to Gotami. It's interesting, he said that she should go into town and bring back a mustard seed. Okay, so she would have known that mustard seeds were really common in every single house. But on one condition, the mustard seed needed to be from a house in which no one had died, in which nobody had died. So her husband had died in her house, so she couldn't go to her house, but she thought, well, I'll just go into another house. I'll try all the houses. So she went from one house to the next, and each time she experienced disappointment. So each time she found that someone had died in that house, and one person said to her, the living are few compared to the dead. And each person responded with their own sort of tale of grief, their own tale of loss, their own story of someone who died in their house. And the realization eventually dawned on her that her son was dead. And she went back, she went to the village charnel ground. And then she did the kind of burial procedure, and then she sang this verse expressing what she realized. And so she said, so no village law is this, and no city law. No law for this clan or for that alone, for the whole world, and even for the gods in heaven, this is the truth. Everything is impermanent. So she went back to the Buddha and replied to the Buddha, the little mustard seed has done its work. The little mustard seed has done its work. And then she asked to become one of the Buddha's disciples and went on to enlightenment. Okay, so in this story, it shows an account of how the Buddha used really, really skillful means to connect the dukkha, the bitter disappointment of Kisa Gotami with other people. And that's what sort of brought her out of her madness, if you like, and what brought her to see reality. Okay, so from this story, I want to draw out two points that the Buddha taught. So one is the first one, bringing others into your awareness. So he brought other people into Kisa Gotami's awareness. And the second one is recognizing that other people also experience suffering as we experience, as all of us experience. Okay, so bringing others into your awareness first. So the first thing really that we need to do to work with this slogan is to recognize that people are people. So people are living and breathing. And this is very, very difficult to do, actually. It's one of my kind of trainings to carry on trying to make effort to see each individual person that I meet as a person and not just like a kind of cardboard cutout living a sort of two-dimensional life. When I was quite young, I had this, I was very young, I think about 6 or 7, I had this thought that I was the only human being in the world and that everyone else was a robot. And it's quite interesting that it's sort of like I didn't quite believe that other people were sort of like me. I think it's very, very difficult to do that. I remember this years later, actually, after reading some Rumi, and I thought, there's no way Rumi was a robot. That's what I thought. Like, his writing is so beautiful and touches like the human condition so deeply. He definitely wasn't a robot. So I thought, well, maybe there's more people, less robots. So there begins the practice of trying to see people as people. So like poetry particularly helped me for a certain period of time. But also it shows the importance of sort of culture and of appreciating other people's work and other people's ideas and thoughts and philosophy. We've got this really rich culture. Really sort of interesting things at our fingertips. It's we can use that to connect with people. So that's all come from people. So seeing people as people. That's a really good description of metta, I think. So expanding our field of awareness to include other people. So there's this Bante quote that I didn't manage to find it. It's from memory. I might be slightly off. But love is the awareness of a being in another person. So it's something like that. That's what love is. That's what metta is. And this awareness, our awareness of others, can either expand or contract. And that's dependent on what we do with our mind. Okay, so I've got some more wonderful artwork to show you about this. Okay, so... Yeah, so you can imagine that that circle is our sphere of awareness, okay, our sphere of awareness around us. And that sphere of awareness can shrink, and as it shrinks, we become less happy, basically. So as we become more sort of self-orientated, self-involved, we become trapped, we become not free. So this is what was happening to Kisa Gotami when she lost her son, her awareness, her field of awareness of other people sort of got smaller and smaller. And we can also expand our awareness, okay? So we can expand it for other people. So that use the sort of generic terms of me in the middle and then there's you out there, so that's sort of bigger, isn't it? And that can expand to include sort of more people and sort of more people. And when it gets sort of big enough, you stop being able to find the middle. You sort of stop being able to find where, like, you are. That's what I think anyway. So, you know, an infinite sphere doesn't have a middle. So I think that sort of works as a metaphor for the expansion of self until you don't sort of have a self. So there's no self-centeredness. There's no kind of middle if that's expanding outwards. And so this is a very, very important practice, sort of the preliminary practice to see other people as people. And other people are all around us. We're literally surrounded by all beings. That is, in fact, the reality. So there's loads of opportunities to sort of try and realize that. Very difficult. There seems to be two near enemies. Some more good drawings here. Okay, so the first one on the left is kind of being aware of people, but without being aware of yourself. So you've got like a sad me in the corner outside of the sphere of awareness. So like you really want to be aware of other people, but you've got no awareness of yourself. And this sort of doesn't last very long. It kind of bursts and you get sort of burnt out with it. So this is like this is the near enemy of serving other people, is sort of forgetting to have yourself and like in the middle particularly. And then the one on the right is sort of becoming too, I don't know what it is, like you can sort of taste it, like too self-involved, too like selfish. I'm not quite sure I have the sort of words, but they're the ways it can get twisted, it seems. And what seems to happen is we sort of go from one to the other. That's what I do. I go from one to the other. So it's like all about other people, then all about me, all about other people, all about me. So part of the practice is to sort of balance it out, to be like this one, like get in the middle. Yeah, and friends, people who are experienced in practicing are really good at spotting this. In my experience, they can really, it's been pointed out quite a few times to me in different ways. This is what's happening. So that's the first point. Is that the first point? Yeah, first point, bringing others into your awareness. Okay. The second point is, so once you've got other people in your awareness, recognizing that our suffering is the same as their suffering, my suffering is the same as your suffering, my sort of disappointments are the same as your disappointments, and all that scale. So we can recognize that just as we suffer, so in that same way other people do. So that, again, this is Kisa Gotami. So just as her son died, other people's friends and family, she found out, oh, they've also died. So it sort of changes from this has happened to me to like this has happened. So it takes the bite out of it being personal. And it changes from a kind of isolated madness into a connected sanity. So it brought Kisa Gotami out of madness and into sanity. So out of isolation, into connection. And it's very, very difficult this. I find this very difficult. But I think it might be true that dukkha is never personal. Dukkha is never personal. So there's no unique suffering or bad thing that can happen to us that hasn't happened to someone else and that won't happen to someone in the future. So there'll be specific details, but the basic kind of disappointment, the basic suffering underneath will be the same. So we're not singled out. Okay, so this recognizing other people's suffering, that suffer, and so do we, that can sort of help expand that. There's a few practices that we do that I found really, really helpful for this, just connecting with people's lives, like the joy and the suffering. So one is life story. So on retreat and in other intensive contexts, we've got this practice in Sri Ratna of telling life stories. So telling life stories and listening to life stories. And it's amazing how sort of varied people's lives are and how all they're basically sort of the same. And the sort of day-to-day scale we do, you know, the more you get involved with True Ratna, the more you'll find yourself checking in. And checking in is, I still haven't quite worked it out, but I think it's a really good practice for me to firstly take someone in as a human being and then connect with their suffering if that's what's happening, or connect with their joy if that's what's happening. So it's a window into all of our lives, so a really important practice. So we're all very unique, but underneath it all, it's all based on the same sort of fundamental conditions of arising and ceasing. Or another way I think of saying that is that, like, things happen to us and then they stop happening, and then other things happen and then they stop happening, and then other things happen, and so on and so on. That's basically the story of our lives, I think. And some of that happening or not happening is, like, really deeply painful. But when we can feel that suffering and sort of recognize the commonality of it, it can connect us to others. So some examples of ways that we can kind of bring this into life. So if you're not sleeping well at night and you're awake at night, the chances are there's lots of other people who are not sleeping well who are also awake at night. So you're forming a, like, this community of insomnia, you know, of not sleeping well. And, like, recognizing that, taking the personal edge off it can be, really sort of liberating. If you're really busy, really stressed, the chances are someone else is really busy and really stressed. If you're stuck in a queue, there's definitely other people stuck in a queue. If you're in a kind of waiting room for whatever it is, like the doctors or the dentist or kind of Howden House, that's a good one for that. And you sort of, like, nobody quite wants to be there, and you can, and it, just to recognize that can help break it out. If you've been blamed unfairly, someone else at that exact moment is definitely being blamed unfairly. And if this is one I experienced, so waking up in the morning and kind of feeling like opening my diary and just feeling like anxious about the day and what's going on in the day. And I just think, God, how many people are doing this now? You know, just feeling anxious about their day. Physical pain. The dentist, I think, is seems to be a common one. I used to go to a student dentist, so I was there a lot, and it took a really long time because they're students. And I actually found that it's a really, really good place to practice connecting with other people's suffering. So student dentist, so it's a big room full of other people. All, you know, so you can see lots of other people lying down, and you can see all the students, like, going, oh. And it's just sort of, and they get really close to you, don't they? Really close to your face, and it's very, very vulnerable. And you can really take, I just find, God, I can really take them in. It's like the ideal conditions almost for really, for practicing it. Yeah, good. And particularly over the summer, over the last 3 months, I had, about 6 months ago, for 3 months, I had really just a very, very difficult time. Very, very, I don't know what it was, a real sort of like depression of life. And I found that I was much more connected with people who experienced that than I could ever be sort of if I'd never experienced it myself. You know, really, it really did a full 180 on my sort of worldview of how difficult it is actually to be sort of conscious. It's definitely not straightforward, and I really got a sense of that. So we can use our suffering and all these sort of scenarios, big and small, to connect us to others. And it really strengthens the mind. So because one of the things that happens when you suffer is your kind of sphere of awareness gets smaller and you become kind of like cramped, it's a really deeply ethical thing to do to try and It's not very pleasant, but it's deeply ethical to try and expand it. It's really, it's karmic heavyweight. It's really good thing to do, to train in these difficult situations if we can. Just because so much effort is required to stretch it back out. To connect that suffering with other people. So yeah, very, very powerful practice. And it can really use suffering to propel us beyond ourselves, our sense of separateness. And it requires all sorts of things, I think. And one of the things is imagination. So really imagining what it's like to be in someone else's shoes. And sort of ethical actions sort of flow from that. They flow from imagination of self and other. So they're the first 2 points. So becoming aware of others and recognizing our shared suffering. So point three, stage three. Okay, so take on the suffering of others. So taking on the suffering of others. So when the slogan takes these two practices a step further and also takes sort of the story of Kisa Gotami a step further. And this is where we meet our slogan again. So train in taking and sending alternately. Let them ride upon the breath. Okay. So this is referring to a practice called Tong Len, which literally means sending and taking. And in the Tibetan tradition, it's a meditation in its own right. And we've got an equivalent meditation within Sri Ratna, within the order, called the Bodhicitta practice. I can't really do it justice because I haven't practiced it enough, but I'll give it a quick, what I think of the chunks of it. So I think there's three main chunks. So the first one is it requires preparation. So before doing the meditation, there's a lot that goes into contacting reverence, actually, and devotion. And usually that's symbolized by a figure, so either a bodhisattva figure, or if it's the Tibetan tradition, a kind of root guru. And you imagine them sort of inhabiting your heart and like sitting in your heart, and your heart becomes a pavilion that's sort of just pervading with light. Okay, so that's the first preparation is to contact like deep reverence and faith, I guess you could say. The second one is a cultivation of metta, so bringing other people to mind, so expanding that awareness out, and contacting gratitude. So these two things like really get the fires of mental states, positive mental states, like going, basically burning. And then the meditation itself, so once you're prepared, the meditation itself. So what I'll do is I'll read an extract from Padmavajra that he wrote about the bodhicitta practice, which is basically the same thing. So just a quick working description of bodhicitta. So bodhicitta is like something like the will for enlightenment for the sake of all beings. So that sort of will kind of like descending on you. So the practice of bodhicitta is creating the kind of consciousness that can arise within. Okay, so don't worry if that didn't make any sort of sense, but that's just what is worth unpacking that word. Okay, so the practice of Tonglen, or the sort of the sequence of it. So in meditation, within meditation, this is what you visualize, this is what you think. So although all beings want to be happy, because of their ignorant deeds, circumstances, and conditions, they suffer. Feel the suffering of others and then see it as a thick black cloud rising out of all beings. On the in-breath, breathe in the black cloud. The black smoke ignites and strengthens your aspiration for bodhicitta. You see this as light in your heart. And as you breathe out, you see the light falling on all beings, bestowing happiness, joy, peace, satisfaction, and even the great bliss itself, even enlightenment itself. Do this over and over, taking in pain and breathing out all that is good to you. The more you take, the more you can give. And the more you can give, the more you can take. Okay, so back to the slogan. So train in taking and sending alternately. Let them ride upon the breath. So train in taking in others' suffering, the black sort of smoke of suffering, and sending out the great light. And do this over and over. And then the sort of post-meditation, after meditation, as far as I can sort of make out, it's continue to do this in all areas of life. Okay, so take it out. And the Tibetan books, the Tibetan texts, they're sort of really interestingly written. The kind of guys say, take it deadly seriously. Like, believe that you are taking in the suffering of others and believe that you're breathing out the brilliant white light. So take it deadly seriously. Concentrate on particular people. Don't sort of abstract it. Don't sort of go for kind of all the bunny rabbits in the world, definitely abstracted. So don't abstract it. Okay. So some questions I have is, how does it work? And does it work? And does it affect other people's suffering? I suppose I don't know. I really like this quote from Bhante. He says, the Buddha has no mania for explanation. So sort of Buddhism doesn't kind of like really feel like it needs to explain itself. Like the proof is in the practicing and the effects. That's kind of what the proof is. And the benefits of doing it as a meditation, you sort of practice it in controlled conditions and you see the effects on you. You can sort of slow it down. And if it goes kind of all goes pear-shaped, the consequences on other people are less, because you're sort of doing it with your eyes closed. So this is a really, it's a very heavy practice and it's a bit intimidating. And you need to sort of work up to it, build up to it, and feel confident in the momentum that you have. And I don't sort of suggest it, basically. I don't suggest it. And if you do do it, then take responsibility for the effects that it's having on your mind. Take responsibility for your own mind. So I've been mostly on retreat, actually, for the last 2 weeks, and I've been... because I knew I was going to give this talk, I was sort of dipping my toe in it. So I was doing that. So after these one of meditations, I had a quick 10-minute power nap. And during my 10-minute power nap, I had this, after, practicing breathing in black, breathing out light, had this sort of like strange kind of dream of this huge... stone giant standing over me with this huge club, just like batting away other people's suffering. Like, no! I thought, oh, okay, good. Yeah, so I've got a message that that it really does. It's really worth taking your time with it. And I don't know whether that sort of that's a kind of symbol of like my selfish preservation or the fact that it's like a positive self-protection. Go carefully or not at all. Don't dismiss it too early. So don't dismiss the slogan too early. So these kinds of practices are what give us our edge, basically, what gives the Sangha our edge. And if you're on really, really good form and you're like really steaming with the Dharma, it's good to push yourself. Hopefully at least one of us will be on good form all the time. So there's a few hundred of us. So if we just get one on good form, sort of doing it for the rest of us, we'll keep our collective edge. I don't know what I'm trying to say really, sort of don't do it and do it at the same time. So a really good quote from Shanti Davis. So whoever wishes quickly to become a refuge for others and themselves should take on the sacred mystery to take the place of others, giving them his or her own. Okay. So undertake the sacred mystery of exchanging self and other, of breathing in suffering and breathing out this sort of great bliss. Okay. So I'll just finish by just saying that this, although this practice isn't completely alien to us, because so it's got similarities with the metta bhavana, so similarities with if we choose to have metta for those that suffer, so that's got similarities with the Tonglen practice. So you know, I've got all these practices of compassion, so the Karuna bhavana, so similarities with the metta bhavana, and also with the transference of merits that a lot of you will know. So the transference of merits and self-surrender is at the end of the puja, and also we have a ritual of doing it after like dharma work, basically. And to weigh the words of the transference of merit is very, very profound. So I think I'll just sort of read the words, because if we get so used to repeating it, we sort of forget what it's saying. So the transference of merit and self-surrender, so this is within our practices. It says, may the merit gained in my acting thus go to the alleviation of the suffering of all beings. So all my merit, may it alleviate all the suffering of all beings. So absolutely outrageous straight away. My personality throughout my existences, my possessions and my merit in all three ways, so body, speech and mind. I give up without regard to myself for the benefit of all beings. So it's basically the Tonglen practice. Just as the earth and other elements are serviceable in many ways to the infinite number of beings inhabiting limitless space, so may I become that which maintains all beings. So all those infinite beings, may I maintain them all, situated throughout space, so long as all have not attained to peace, to enlightenment. So sort of like hidden within our sort of basic practices is like the most one of the most profound Buddhist teachings. Okay, so I think I'll just conclude now. So I've talked about three things. I've talked about transforming our dukkha by using it as a way to connect with others, and these three stages of awareness of others. So, that, you know, getting a big awareness of others, expanding our awareness, a recognition of our shared suffering, and taking on the suffering of others. And it might sound like a mad idea to take on the suffering of others, but you can use it, it can be used to deeply connect with others. So if we prepare ourselves thoroughly and do it properly, it's one of the most sane things that we can do. And I have heard it said that if you want to achieve something, then you have to aim higher than what it is you actually want to achieve. So if we want to eliminate our own suffering and break through to enlightenment, we have to aim much higher than that. We have to aim to want that for every single person, for everyone else as well. Okay, thank you.